Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Relative Pitch. We are so excited to have the Dr. Sheldon Williams on with us today. Dr. Williams is the Associate Director of Bands and the Director of Athletic Bands at West Virginia University, which, by the way, let me just say this. Him and his ensemble, I mean, the Macy's Day Parade, right? Like, you just did that, right, Dr. Williams?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, kudos, congratulations.
Yes.
We're
Thank you.
so happy. And I know that was a wonderful experience for you and your students. So bravo to all of you. So Dr. Williams, can you tell us a little bit how you got to, the person, the head in charge at West Virginia? Give us a little background about you.
Well, I could start as early as okay, so we all, I guess, have an origin story.
Yes.
And my origin story dated back to seventh grade when I heard the piece Nathan Hale Trilogy being played by Kurt. It was written by Curnow, but we played it at our music assessment that year. And the band was spread out because scheduling conflicts, we all know how that goes.
Yes.
The woodwinds had to meet a specific block, the brass had to meet a specific block, and percussion was a class, of its own. But we would come together after school. And my favorite band teacher, she was fantastic, Miss Vonda Palmer Carter, set me on this path. I don't know if she knew that she was setting me on this path, but she was a an alumni of FAMU, and she was in the Marching 100, one of the very few female baritone players at that time. And to hear her play was to almost hear God speak through that instrument. I just remember how fantastic she was. Well, we all got together after school. All of the parts came together, all the component parts of the band came together, and we played through the second movement of Nathan Hale Trilogy. And we finally heard the percussion and how it added, and the warmth and color of the woodwinds. And I, at the time, was a tuba player. All of the elements came together, and she was recording because I think she was going to send it to a friend or so of hers or take it home to kind of sort of review as we get ready for assessment. And in the middle of her recording, the big crescendo happens in the middle of that movement. I still remember it now. And full body chills. And it was so impactful on everyone in the room that we all, like loud black children, we all like stopped and was like, woo, like we were catching the Holy Ghost. Because this was the first time that we had heard this thing come together like this. And for me, it was like a songbird, this imaginary songbird came and landed on my shoulder for the first time. And I've been chasing that songbird ever since seventh grade. And there have been a lot of things that have happened in between now and then. I went to Florida State University for my undergrad, and I didn't learn enough the first time, so I had to go back another time for my master's, did the summer master's program there. And the second I was done with the master's program, I applied for UT Austin. I was accepted but deferred because Anthony or Tony Marinello, I forget where he's at right now, in Illinois. He was taking up an assistantship, and I had to wait for him to finish in order for me to take that assistantship. So I was a little bummed. I was thinking, oh man, I'm not gonna be able to go when I thought I was gonna be able to go. Well, I hung up the phone, and one of my dearest friends called me and said, "Hey, while you're in this quote unquote gap year, why don't you come and teach at New Mexico State University?" So I packed up all of my stuff, and I was the interim associate director of bands there, director of athletic bands. And I was that for a year. Then, after I was done with that, the assistantship had freed up. I'd gone over and met a lot of really fabulous people at University of Texas at Austin. And I graduated just in time for y'all's pandemic to strike. And as a
Y'all.
result, I ended up graduating virtually. I walked the stage with a fabulous bottle of wine in my living room
Yes.
and like my pandemic besties. And then I got in my car after a while and drove cross country and started a brand new life in the middle of a pandemic in West Virginia. And I've been here for 5 years since. This is year number five that I'm on.
Wow.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
First of all, I love hearing the origin story and the path because something that we always emphasize to our audiences when we have guests, especially, is like, no, there's not one singular path. And what you were just saying about how you were like disappointed, you really wanted to go to UT like right then, but then you got to go have this experience where you got like, opportunities and everything in New Mexico, which by the way, I went to University of New Mexico. So like, that's so far
Oh, okay.
crossover.
Wonderful.
But that's like amazing, like because I'm sure you got so much invaluable experience just from that 1 year of teaching and like learning and that you were able to take into your doctorate that helped inform you. And so it's just really beautiful to hear that you found that value even in a path that you didn't see yourself on. You were like, oh, I really thought I was going to immediately go to my DMA, but you got that opportunity. And like, so when you're advised, because I'm sure you advise so many students, like of
Sure.
what to do next, when you share your story with them, do you feel like that eases them that, oh, it may not be exactly what I thought I was going to be doing, but it's ultimately what I am doing, meaning it's what I was meant to be doing.
Right. Yeah, I do. And I think whenever people tell their truth or speak their truth, it does put people at ease around them. Sometimes there is this need to present perfection that I'm not necessarily a fan of because it lacks authenticity sometimes. But you know, the path to wherever it is that you're going to go might be met with some disappointments and some things that are unexpected. I was teaching public schools in South Florida for 12 and a half years, and I had no intention of leaving. And once I finished the master's, I had, you know, dear friends of mine. I call them my guardian angels. They're the people that tell me, Sheldon, go over here, go over there, do this thing, do that thing. And I have to tell you, I had no intention, zero intention of being somebody's collegiate band director. It was just not in the cards for me. But I had people that told me, hey, you really should. And I thought, you know what? This is what I'm going to do because I was so convinced that I was going to be a high school band director, which is nothing wrong with that for sure, 100% nothing wrong with that. Because at this point, I've spent more time in secondary than I have at the collegiate level, just so that we're like beyond clear about that. But I said to them, you know, I'm going to play a little bit of a game of Russian roulette with the universe. I'm going to apply for one school. And if I don't get into that school, that's okay. I am going to move forward with life in the path that I thought I was going to be on. But I owed it to myself that when something's introduced to you, you can either say yes or no. And I was at a moment of saying yes to all the possibilities that were coming my way. And I just started saying yes to that. I said yes, I filled out the application, did all the things, and begrudgingly submitted it because what I wanted to do secretly was just to say, well, see, I told you it wasn't for me, you know, but I did press, pardon me, did press submit, and it turned out to be the best decision that I've ever made. It's just saying yes to myself, saying yes to moving forward, and saying yes to the possibility of more.
The possibility of more. It's funny because, your first analogy was like a songbird flying in and flying away. And that's kind of how I, as you were speaking, I'm seeing you, going through landing and changing lives for the better. I mean, it's very beautiful to see. Can you talk a little bit about how, navigating through being a public education teacher for so long, how it affected you, and how were you able to, make it the best situation for you?
Now, you said navigating through being a public school educator for so long, and then it cut out, and the last thing I heard was you. I'm so sorry, I'm having internet issues.
You're fine. Just navigating through that public ed band director life for so long, and you, like, who is Sheldon Williams in that arena?
That's a very, very big question that I am still unwrapping right now, if I had to be straight up about that. But the public school aspect tied into my upbringing. I worked on a construction site. Since I was 5 years old, it was my family's business. So I understand, and also while I was in Florida, right after I graduated from high school and was doing a little work, after I graduated from college, pardon me, was starting my first job, I also became a certified licensed Florida contractor in plastering and stucco, which was my family's business. I held that certification for a very long time before I realized I was not going to do anything with it. So I decided to let that whole thing go. The reason why I bring that up is because it was hard work being in public school, being at the higher ed level, being anywhere is incredibly hard work. So there's a lot of time on, there's a lot of FaceTime with students. There's a lot of man hours, hands-on man hours in the secondary setting. And I felt like my time on the construction site with my family, with my dad, with my siblings, that level of always on, even Saturdays when people got to sleep in a little bit, I was still getting up because there was a job set, a job site to prep or a job site to take down is what we would do on those weekends. Or we would go scouting for jobs and seeing, potential things that would be coming up. So that always on while I was in construction and growing up in that environment prepared me for higher ed. And not, it prepared me, pardon me, for secondary and ultimately for higher ed. But those 12 and a half years that I was working in South Florida at J.P. Taravella High School, I felt like I was uniquely prepared to always show up, always be ready for the next level of challenge, always be ready to put in the hours, the fundraising, the preparations for huge events. We had some fantastic events there, to host district assessment, to do all of those things. So I felt like I was uniquely prepared to take all of that stuff on. And how does that relate to who I am? It's just all I know, just to show up and bust your behind to make it happen. So that's just kind of sort of been my story.
I love that. It was I have a friend in town right now, and she's been doing some work with some of the schools that I work with, And she went and
Sure.
taught at a middle school for me. And she was like, I'm tired. I was like, yes. Them kids, how we love them. They got so much energy. And it's just like, you're on from whenever you show up to whenever you leave. And when you get in your car, you're like,
Yes.
okay. And then you just like get your second wind. You're like, okay, let me go be a human now.
Right.
Let me go live my little afternoon life. So when you were teaching secondary, I like asking this question. What were your like little, was there anything like your students knew you were going to say this when they messed up? Or like whenever you stopped, you're like, okay, so y'all know what I'm going to say. Was there any like little vocal stems, as the kids call them nowadays, of Mr. Williams from back in the day? Or Doc, who's Mr. Williams back then? Now it's Dr. Williams.
Well, there was one thing that I always said is once I finish something, I'm in South Florida, so it's all about the sass. So once I would finish saying something, if I was making a really big point, it would be like, hello, goodbye, is what I would say at the end. Once I have made a point. So it turned into a thing with some of my students that will still reach out today. And there's a little bit of that. I actually stole it from my violin tech who came in. She was a good friend of mine. And she was this spicy Chinese lady. And she would always be screaming at the students. And at the end, she's like, hello, hello, with her dialect. And that hello, goodbye started to become a thing for all of us that were teaching there.
I love it. I love it. Something, you just pointed this out as you were kind of sharing a little bit about how your upbringing helped to inform you as an educator. When you are, especially now within higher ed, and you're teaching students who may be working on their own, but also it's a mix, right? Because you have undergraduates who their schedules are so insane and so busy that they feel like they have to stay on campus. And one of my biggest things as like I've been a TA is like go away from campus. Go like see what else is happening in the world. Don't just like enclose yourself in this little bubble. And it's so interesting how that was just something that happened for you at a young age, is that you just had these other skills that helped inform you of how to do your job to the best of its ability, and like just how to handle managing time, managing stress, etc. So I mean, is there, do you try to like, talk to your students, encourage them to be more than just music and be more than just that degree and really go out to see what else is going on in the world to help inform them of what they want to do?
Yes. So every year, I, for my leaders, I host a leadership seminar. Sometimes it's only, one day. This year, it was a 2-day seminar. And they look forward to it because I'll find whatever hot button, fabulous little book, thought process that's out there right now. And I will actually wrap that into my teaching. And it's also helped me to establish the mission statement for the Pride of West Virginia Marching Band. And that mission statement actually came from my first seminar, leadership seminar that I taught for them. It's always emphasizing the human. I'm always emphasizing who they need to be and making sure that they understand the skills transfer. While I absolutely love y'all's band, I do. However, comma, if I can't use it elsewhere, then I don't find it valuable. And even when I'm on trips, let's say we just went to, oh gosh, what was it, Kansas City. We went to their Big 12 championships. I took the women or the men, I don't know which one I took, but we all got on a bus, and I was like, we're going to spend the afternoon at a museum. We grabbed our stuff, everybody got on the bus, we went to Fabulous Museum in Kansas City. And I went to this one wing of the museum, and there was this Monet hanging up. It was the Monet where there was like sea or river grass. I think it's called river grass. I'm not exactly sure. You may have to check me on that. But there was river grass and this cascading river behind. And in the background was this French industrial town that was a little bit out of focus. But the river grass was the thing that was the most important. And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to go and stare at this picture and see this painting and see what all the hype is about. I am going to question Monet, Let me go and see what this is all about. I stood there in perfect silence for maybe 10, 15 minutes looking at the same thing. And the students would come and chit chat with me, and then they would go away because I just told them, like, go and experience this on your own. I'm going to take my time this time. Because I'd already gone to that museum before on a previous trip with different students. But I'm going to sit here and see what I can grasp from this experience. And I looked at that picture, and I swear, the blades of grass started moving and the river started moving. And I thought to myself, what is making this great is that I think that he was able to capture the essence of real life in this picture. And I'm like, oh, I can transfer this to so many things. How else can I use this? The next day, I went into class and I talked to the students all the time about transfer. Next day, well, the next time I had class, the next week, I went into class and I said that, I wanted to dismantle or to try to break apart why this Monet wasn't exactly great, And I ended up using it so effectively to explain to the students that we are artists ourselves. We are simply painting with sound. Those brush strokes that he was using that made the thing come to life was an absolute master class in picking colors and making sure that those colors did exactly what they were supposed to do. And the shape of how he used the brush or the air was exactly what it needed to do to make the thing come alive. And you, of course, know as a flute player, all the efforts that are taken to create color with that instrument. We do it all the time in the wind band setting. So this needs to be a little bit more maroon. This needs to be, can that be a lighter brush stroke there? Can this do this? Can that do that? So I started to experiment with that for the next couple of weeks, exclusively talking to the students as if they were standing next to me, looking at that river grass painting, that Monet. So I kept going back to that, and I often tell the students that whatever it is that we're taking on now, this is the long way back to what we were talking about. Whatever it is that we're talking about now, is there a way that it can transfer to your everyday life, in a way that makes you human and a way that you can use and to learn from? Those are the things that I'm interested in.
Wow. Putting the value in the human experience of what we do. I mean, this is no shade. I'm currently teaching in Texas. We all know Texas is great. We know. But I've just, we all know the stereotype of that these are numbers, these are machines, they play, boom, and then they're gone. And I'm always thinking about like, but these are people. They feel, they hear, they breathe. What else can they get from this besides burning out after 12th grade and then never wanted to pick up their instrument again because we
Sure.
used and abused them for so long now, where we have forgotten the humanistic element of what makes this beautiful. Because music, it has breath to it. If it would be a MIDI file, and we know what that sounds like. There's a difference
Right.
between that. But the only way music will have that ability to breathe is if we take that moment to establish a connection with each other first. And so hearing you talk about that, and hearing you say transfer, that kind of triggered me a little bit because all of our professors at Kennesaw State was Florida State grads, and so they taught us the whole transfer and intent versus function and all those terms. I was like, oh my gosh, like I remember this very well. So and now that you reminded me, I think I'm gonna take that for myself of, how can this be transferred? Come on now, we've all been, band kids or music kids. There's so much you learn in those classrooms that could be transferred to doctors, lawyers, anything like that. And I'm sure, you have students who are, not professional musicians that are probably doctors saving lives somewhere, but they have that thing that you taught them in school that is like, that's why they keep coming back and doing it even more. That's beautiful.
Right. That's why I do it, because I just know they're probably not all going to be music majors, especially at the secondary level. And when they get to the university level, you may have students sitting in. I teach the second band here at WVU. I have students in my ensembles that are not music majors that just love music. Come on, sit down and catch these hands.
Grab a chair, make sure you in tune, and let's articulate together. No, we are you as you were talking about, like, what life skills can they carry on into the next, like, even if they're a music major or not. I took that as a big thing when I took over the pep band at my university this year, because what the trouble of the pep band last year was navigating higher ups and that ne and how to, like, network and just communicate with them. And I made it like a master class. I'm like, hey, if you're in the corporate world, there's a couple of people you always you need every time you see them, smile, shake their hand, be like, oh my God, how are you doing? We're having a great day. If you're a music major, you need to always see your athletic principal. And when you see them, you give them a big old smile and shake their hand. And they saw, like, because every time I went, I saw the president of the university at our pep band games. I would go smile, shake his hand, make sure he knew my name and I knew his. The athletic director, the assistant athletic director, the space manager. And they saw me navigate these relationships. And then the pep band this year got uniforms for the first time for free, got jackets for the first time for free, got tuba covers for the first time. We got to be on the floor where we wanted to be. Like, we got so many perks because you make a connection and a relationship with somebody and you tell them that you want to be there and they want you there, but they have to see that you have skin in the game and they need to have skin in your game. And how to operate, like, relationships, and relationship works in every field. If you can build a relationship with somebody, you will have, like, even if it's your boss, even if it's your subordinate, if you don't know how to, like, work with colleagues or work with students or work with somebody who's underneath you as good as you work with people above you, you're not going to be a good colleague. And so showing the student, like, the students, I have the same amount of respect. I say, hey, here's your call sheet. Here's everything. Here's my call sheet. I'm going to tell you when I'm going to be at every game. I'm gonna be there 15 minutes before you are. And if I'm down on my game, my leaders need to call me out. But if you're down on your game, we have to call each other out. So I'm gonna hold myself accountable. We hold you accountable. And it's this, like, building this trust back into an ensemble that was kind of slipping away at my university. And now we're gonna have to hold auditions next year, and I'm scared about it. But it's okay. We'll face that battle when we get to August.
It's going to be great.
So, Sheldon, with all the humanistic, aspects of what we do, one thing that, I mean, we have known each other for some years now, and I have been just following you and so proud of you, especially after you graduated UT. 2020 was a hell of a year. I mean, the pandemic, what's going on, but also Black Lives Matter, social justice reforms, all these things happening. And then through that, a couple of years later, you kind of in your rediscovery series with Florence Price and Adoration. Can you talk about how you started that process? And did that start at UT, or was that something that's kind of always been in your brain for a while that you've always wanted to take on and do?
Well, you talk to anybody in higher ed and they'll tell you the same thing. Sometimes you pick the research. You're like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. These are the things that I'm interested in. But sometimes that research picks you. There is a friend of mine who had come across Adoration, and he's like, man, his name is Michael Garassi. He's over at UMHB, University of Mary Hardin Baylor. And he was a really dear friend of mine from South Florida. He was also a former band director at the high school that I was working at for 12 years. And he says, man, on a whim, oh, you're teaching arranging, you should do an arrangement of this Adoration. And I thought to myself, in the middle of marching season, as basketball season is starting up, we still have three new shows to learn, and we do a new show every home game. So there's six new shows to put out, and I'm either doing arrangements for that, or writing drill, or some combination of that. And I said to him, "There's no way, Mike. I'm so busy. I can't possibly do this." I sat down and did it because I'm always listening to guardian angels, right? If they come to me and they whisper, you need to go in this direction, I always listen. And I started listening and I sat down to put the first couple of notes on the page for this Adoration transcription. And it I won't say it wrote itself because it was very, 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 very intentional. Some of the things that I did, some of the influences that I used in that transcription slash arrangement, that Florence Price and the Rediscovery series was a reaction to everything that you were speaking of, with George Floyd, with Black Lives Matter, and me taking this project on. And the second I started it, thinking I need to make this a series. Because for me, what was really big was that I didn't really hear about Florence Price for real, you guys ready? Until the first year of my doctoral school, my DMA.
That's
Because I
great.
had great music history teachers, right? But there was so much happening to uphold the canon. And once that little crack showed in the face of all of this stuff that was going on, right? Once that one little crack showed, I went all the way in. And of course, George Walker is the second one that I did. And I went back to Florence Price for the third one and am currently researching for the fourth. But the second that crack showed, like, wait a minute, why aren't you? Well, my first question was, why hasn't anybody done this for the Black composers that were overlooked? And the answer to that was, why haven't you done this? So I just started to go in with that. And the rest, I will say, is still unfolding. But it was in response to a lot of what was going on in the wake of 2020. We all spent a lot of time alone. And I want Black music, I want underrepresented composers, I want females, I want all of these people to have the same treatment, the same gravitas when they're performed as any of our like canonized composers. And with that adoration, Florence Price, I wanted to wash her music through the lens of a Wagner. I wanted to wash her music through the lens of a Strauss or a Mahler. They were relatively close to her dates, so they were her contemporaries of sorts. So I wanted to see what I couldn't do to wash her music through that lens and give it the same level of I don't want to say importance, but I wanted it to have the same level of visibility. And where I knew I needed to start was at the secondary level. So that piece of music was written, the transcription was written to engage secondary music students so that they could have access to something I never had access to when I was sitting in the band chairs, to see a Black female composer on their stand for an honor band, for an all-state, or to even have it be on their stands for an evaluation. It was recently played at a Las Vegas district assessment, or region assessment, whatever they call it out there. But I feel really, really proud that these students have access to knowing that there are Black female composers that are killing the game. And it will be your favorite piece of music that you play on the concert. And yes, it was written by someone that you may not have had access to. If you were not an organ player or if you were not in the symphony. So I needed that to come to the band world.
On that, not only will it be your favorite piece that you would have played, it would be the favorite piece you've heard. I sat through concerts and Adoration has been on that on the program, and that has always been the piece that just, oh my gosh, that was the piece. And it is beautifully done. You can tell your intention in that piece. It is threaded through. I mean, Florence Price, her music is just extraordinary, but the detail you took by transcribing it for winds and for this medium, it's beautiful and it was needed. It's occupying a space that was void before. And I think it absolutely gorgeous. And I will also
Oh, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, oh my God, everyone loves Adoration. It's just
Oh,
great.
yes.
And for the other thing, you said organ players and you said symphony, but also some of those choir composers. There's a lot of African American women and men choir composers. William Dawson, obviously, done both realms, but Moses Hogan, all of these people, those are the things that I said this on a couple weeks ago when I was presenting at a conference. When we look at the scale, choir over here has a lot more representation of Black culture and music of the diaspora than band. And orchestra, it like literally goes choir, orchestra, and then band. So we have to do these things to start to build up that representation in this medium that we've all fallen in love with. And I just applaud you for taking those steps and doing that for us because it is really, really needed for the next generation to see us on those stands when they come in the classroom. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I always, whenever I talk about my programming, because I especially after 2020, we graduated undergrad in 2020, and my own personal reckoning was like realizing I had never played a piece by a Black female composer, and that shook me, like, because it was like I have never played music by someone who literally has this a similar identity in terms of like race and gender as me. And so as soon as I realized that for my master's recitals and for my doctoral recitals, it was mainly only first of all, definitely female, but it's like as much black women and women of color that I could like program and have on like, and those are the pieces. And just, yeah, of course, just more black composers as well. Those are the pieces that people are like, oh my God, what is that piece? Or like all the flute players are like, can you send me the sheet music for that? I really want to see blah, blah, blah. And people are just like, what was that one piece? And I was like, that was the Rena Ishmael. Like, and being able, just immediately understanding how significant it is for you as a performer to be performing pieces that actually speak to you and how much that changes things for the audience. Because I think I played like Lily Bollinger's, yeah, right, the knock her nocturne that she wrote, and it was around the time when she was about to pass and everything. And it was actually arrangement that was, it was written originally for violin, but you know, we flutists like to steal some violins. But for the first piece of any of my recitals, I like to play something that I feel like I can sing and I can sing through, especially as being a flute player. And I remember playing this piece, and I opened with that, and I closed with Sean Okpebholo's Balm in Gilead for flute, mezzo soprano, and piano. And this woman like comes up to me after, where her friend's kind of like, you know, holding her up a little bit, and she just was like, that is the piece that like my mother used to sing for me. And she just passed, like I think she said that this was the anniversary of the year that her mother had passed. She just was like, it spoke to me so much, and like the piece itself, but like how you guys played it and everything. And there's always been that ever since I changed my repertoire to really reflect me. It is that, the when you said it as soon as we started, when you're honest about it, everyone calms, everyone feels more connected to you, to the music, to what we're trying to do. That is what I always emphasize to anyone who I speak to about the repertoire choice I do. I'm like, it's not because I just want to play something, it's because it is more impactful for me and for you if I do something that is authentic to myself. So having the people who are like you, who are doing that work to arrange, transcribe, to find the composers who are doing the work to like just put their identity in their, in the notes that they put for other people to see themselves within, is so important that we're able to have that, because how else are we going to develop ourselves?
It is an important thing, but sometimes just recently, every 4 years, I tend to program something that is a reflection of America. And I did this program titled Americans We. And of course, we don't know, or we do know, it could be worth some investigating, but Henry Fillmore has a very, very, very dark past with America in terms of his minstrel band. Was one of the last minstrel bands that was around. Now, on top of that, he had the moniker of Bennett, who wrote all of the technique books that were in like the early band rooms. This person was, on the one hand, really, really great for the development of quality band ensembles, but on the other hand, had this sordid past. And while I am programming stuff that is, I think, representative of for this program especially, was representative of America, I think it's also sometimes okay to show America in her fullness. And that might involve having a minstrel composer on the program and giving a slight jab in the program notes, just so that people are aware that I'm aware as to why I programmed this and why we need to be looking at it still, because this has not gone away 100%,
Ooh.
you know?
Yeah.
Especially with, not to bring political things, but to just because it's freshly on the news of the censorship in museums, as you were talking about, taking your students to museums. And literally a couple of weeks ago, it was broadcasted that certain things will be removed from museums because it paints America in a bad image. And you were saying about sometimes America has never been the most clean-cut girl on the street. We got to show the duality and the multitude of lives in America. And by doing that, I think, as you said, I know this history, and so should you. That's the big
Right.
thing about this program. America and its vast history. It is wonderful.
I think that needs to be a quote. America has not been the cleanest. What'd you say, Anthony?
Cleanest cut girl.
On the
Never been
street,
the cleanest cut girl.
that has to
Never.
go. That needs to go. Yeah, that has to go somewhere in the history books, right there.
Yes, as we all know. And so, Sheldon, as you've done Lyric for Strange, which was George Walker's, it was the Pulitzer winning Lyric for Strange. And so how taking on that, you maybe discover something new, then adoration, and how was that process with that piece as your second in the Rediscovery series?
So I chose very deliberately not to mess with George Walker's music too much. It was intentional for me to leave it in its intended key because I feel like key signatures have personalities. And sometimes when you wash a key in the transcribing or arranging process, you washed l music a line through a different key, it feels different. So I tried, it is in a key with a lot of flats, and I tried to move it around. Oh, well, I could just solve it if I just bring it down one half step. And hearing it in the key of F major like hurt my soul a little bit. And so I left the music exactly as it was, but my process was different in that I wanted to prove with Florence Price that she deserved a seat at the table with the Strausses, with the Mahlers, with the Wagners. So I used her music and actually paired it with some of those aesthetics that we're all used to. The Elsa's Procession, the Strauss Serenades, the Mahler Fifth, which is what inspired me to add harp to Adoration, right?
You
That
got me.
Adagietto was something that I wanted to bring to this piece of music. So, of course, we did that. Then I completely threw away anything that I had done from an arrangement slash transcribing standpoint. I threw that away to pick up George Walker. And for me, that was just 100%. Let me reimagine this for an ensemble that I know that could do it just as much justice. And you think about a string ensemble, such a homogenous sound, but it's a beautiful sound. It's incredible, and it could be extremely colorful, and expressive. But I thought, now I have access to trumpet. Now I have access to trombone. Now I have access to saxophone and English horn and oboe and all of these things. And one thing that was a bit of a risk, I have access to percussion.
Believe
Or a piece that was not envisioned with that. So I sat with that for a while, and there was a moment where I removed the percussion altogether. But I thought there was an opportunity there. And I just decided that I would take advantage of that opportunity. But in general, there were lines that I found super expressive. And I thought to myself, I have to fix this arrangement so that the horn has this line at this part. I have to fix this arrangement so that the flute has the line at this point. At the apex, the flute is playing a high B flat. I have to fix this so that, these instruments are being featured at certain moments to create quiet, to create calm, and go back to what we were talking about earlier to create the right colors for the moment while I was trying to paint with sound a little bit.
Yeah, I when whoever is listening to this episode, I really want you to pay attention to how Dr. Williams is talking so intellectual about this music, because for so many people, whenever they think music from the diaspora, African American musicians, African American composers, it automatically goes on a feel, or is this, that little statement, it's jazz. It's not. It's intellectual property. It's intellectual intent. And the way you're talking about the music and your way of washing this to make it for a new ensemble, it has a level of detail. And I want everybody to know that you have to perform that piece with a high intellectual detail so that you can get those minute things through it. It cannot be just a piece that is on the program. Oh, let's just read it and we perform it. No, we got to give it this just due, just as we give anything else in our canon. And so thank you so much for, talking about that highly, that sophisticated, because that is what our music is. That's who we are as a people. So, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm glad you did a transcription of it for band. The first time I heard this piece was last year in my orchestra. We did a program and it was like a young person's piece that opened it. Then we did Appalachian Spring. Then we did Walker Lyric for Strings, and then we did Pines of Rome. And just to see something like George Walker's Lyric for Strings on that program with Appalachian Spring and Pines of Rome, I was like, yes. And then what made me happy is I saw the rehearsal schedule get released. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. They're actually spending more time on this than like Appalachian Spring. Because everybody in the orchestra knows it. We've all played it before. The
Right.
strings, they usually, when you do an only string piece in orchestra, you're going to do adagio for strings probably, or something like that. And to see them like spend a lot of time on the walker, I just sat out. I never listened to the strings because I think they're boring. But I sat out in the audience and I'm just being for it. I sat out in the audience and I said, this is just beautiful. I wish there was a band version. Lo and behold, here we have it comes.
Oh, again, as we've said, you were occupying the space as you're bringing others, the forgotten composers with you into the 2020s and to this century. And I just want to say that songbird that first dropped on your shoulder when you were in seventh grade, that songbird has transformed into others, other just songbirds landing on other people, because generation, that's a bird that's like, oh, we have to always try to strive for this beauty. So talent and your musicianship is transforming into others and inspiring others. And it is so beautiful to see. And we are so thankful for you to come and speak with us on Relative Pitch today. It was truly a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I appreciate it. And it was so nice to chit chat with you guys. It really did feel like a conversation that we would be having at a Starbucks, or that we would be having, anywhere over dinner. This was really, really great. And the work that you guys are doing is to be commended.
Thank you. To our listeners, before you go, Dr. Williams, can you let everyone know that's listening, where can they find you, just in case they want to reach out to you about research things, or just to chat? How can they be become part of your village?
That's a really tough one for me, because I don't propose to have a village. Some people love having, their disciples, and that's not a thing for me. If I could say one thing is that I believe 100% in horizontal relationships versus vertical relationships. No matter who we are or where we are, if we're on a horizontal plane, you may be walking ahead of me, but we're all going in the same direction. I don't like to think of myself being on top or somebody else being on top of me being on the bottom. We're all on our way. But in terms of getting in contact with me and sharing community with me, you could reach me on Instagram or on Facebook or email me. I'm available. It'll probably take me about a day to reach your email, but if you email my school email, I will for sure be happy to get in contact with some people and keep the conversation going about the work, number one, that I'm doing, but the work that we're all collectively doing for this medium, but also for classical music.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, listeners. I hope you really enjoyed this wonderful podcast. Please stay tuned for some more episodes. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.